Hello and welcome to Under the Flyover, the podcast strand from inside Croydon. All of Us Strangers is the acclaimed movie from director Andrew Haig, named as the British Film of the Year, with much of it filmed on location in Croydon. Here, recorded in our special Q&A at the David Lean Cinema, Haig is interviewed by Guardian film critic Peter Bradshaw and the cinema's patron Joanna Scanlon. Hear how Andrew Haig was drawn back to his childhood home in Sanderstead to shoot the film, his memories of seeing Bucks Fizz at the Fairfield Halls, and of growing up in Croydon in the 1980s.
I shall stand over here. I shall sit over here.
Should I sit in the middle? Or do you want
yes,
to
sit in the middle.
Thank you very much. I'm wearing this headset, which is this is my era's tour moment. It's this. Everybody else just gets a normal microphone, but I get this headset, which is absolutely great. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm very, very proud and pleased and thrilled to be convening this discussion. This is my third time watching this film. And I was saying to Andrew, it only gets worse. It only gets more. I mean that in a good way. It only gets more. Oh, this is already starting.
Cough if you
feel.
You have to sort of put it on like, yeah. As if it's on the side.
Yeah.
Not over the top.
Like, I had no preparation for doing this.
It's around the back.
Literally. It's not. This doesn't have to Taylor Swift, does it?
I've never had this in a Q&A, so
no.
I quite like this.
Talk amongst
us. Does that work? Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Anyway, sorry about that. This is very unusual, isn't it? I'm thrilled to be here with two insanely talented Croydon-connected people. One, of course, is Joanna Scanlon, the patron of the David Lean Cinema, who lives in Croydon, and of course Mr. Andrew Haig, who was brought up in Croydon, and my new friend Michael, who works here at the David Lean Cinema, said that before you with this film made the Whitgift Centre iconic, before that it was more associated with being the filming locations for many episodes of Terry and Jude,
which I loved Terry and Jude.
Oh, you're welcome. Yeah. I mean, we all did. So I my brain can't absorb that paradox right now. But what I really want to talk to you about, and I'd love to get Joanna's take on this, is those there are so many mind-blowing scenes, but the mind-blowing scenes with the parents in the house, which, as I understand it, was that really your parents' house?
Yeah. Yeah.
And it was not merely the exteriors. I assumed it was the exteriors, but you built the interiors on... was it the interiors were real as well?
It was all the interiors. Everything was the same house. And bizarrely, like, it was such a weird one because when I was writing it, I didn't expect to go and shoot in the house. But every time I was thinking of a childhood home, all that came into my mind was my own childhood home. And I lived there from about 2 till 8 years old, I guess, or 7 years old, so just that period of time.
Right.
But it was so imprinted in my mind, and I'm 51 now, so it's a long time ago. But so imprinted in my mind, and then when we were talking about locations, I was like, why don't we just go and have a look at it? So I went down, and there's a photo in the film, Andrew lifts up this photo and looks at the house, and that was actually a photo of me and my mum, like, originally, with Claire Foy put into it. I just decided to shoot in the actual place.
That was incredible. And you literally knocked on the door and said, I'm so sorry, you're going to have to move out.
Totally. And he was very happy to. He was like, yeah, I'll go, it's fine. What's so weird is that if you go past it now, you see it in the film, there's these huge trees outside the house. And it's like every other house on the street seems to have been renovated, apart from that one. It was the only house on the street. So as I walk past it, it's like it's been waiting, like, all of these years. And those trees, when we first moved in, were just planted. So they were like saplings, basically. So that, for some reason, that freaked me out more than anything else, was like, the size of that tree, that is exactly how long I've been on this planet for.
Oh, my God.
That tree. And
that's,
I don't know what,
so
I was just
going
to sit under the tree and be like, I don't know, this is just freaking me out, these trees. So, yeah, it was a weird experience.
But, Joe, what did you think? Did you think, as I did, what can it have been like for the actors? Because there's no template for those scenes. I don't think almost any other scene in any other film I see. So there's a love scene or a date scene or a death scene. Or blah 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 blah. Oh yes, the scene where you go and visit the ghosts of your parents who are the same age as you. Well, if we're not sure how to play this scene, let's look back at all those other films which have had that scene. Oh no, wait, there haven't ever been any other films like that. What did you think? What would it be like as an actor when you saw that? Did you think, how would I play this? What did you think?
Well, the first thing is just to congratulate Andrew on the most exquisite performances that you elicited from that quartet. It's just the most beautiful collection of performances that work incredibly interconnectedly. And I thought that when the first time I saw it, and then since then we've been through the whole collection of award ceremonies and so forth, and I don't feel it's been as justifiably honoured as it should have been. I think these are the best performances of the year, and they work together. So, and often in terms of awards and things, that always works against you, actually, doesn't it? Because you don't get the sort of obvious direction. But I don't know how you did it, but I think particularly with the intimacy of the performances, the camera work is so close all the time. You feel like you are in bed with them, and you're in the sex scenes with them. You're in the parental bed with them. And actually seeing it listening to it and hear the sound was really wonderful, because that's another thing, the way the sheets rustle, you're just there with them, and it's an extremely intimate relationship that we have as a viewer of their performances. I mean, in terms of how, I mean, Claire Foy, I'm just in awe of her performance, really properly so.
Yeah.
And I think because she embodies that sort of idea of a woman of yesteryear with the attitudes that were very real, and I'm sure everybody would agree that it's very, one can remember, every time he says, it's not like that now, it's different. That's true, but it's not that long ago. The way she played that, there was no dodging. She could have kind of apologised a little bit for those attitudes, and she doesn't at all. And I felt I was back in, really back in my childhood, sort of late 70s, and it was very, very palpable. But as to your question, Pete, the it's very genre-busting film, isn't it? It's a ghost story. It's a sex erotic film. It's a romance, and it's a psychological thriller with a mystery, and all of those sort of, so you can't pull out of the bag any set of tricks.
But
you know, that would be my estimation. Yeah. It is a completely special piece of work. I don't know if they felt it at the time.
It was a weird one. Look, I was nervous, definitely, because, you know, usually when you're trying to make a film, everyone wants to know, what's it going to be like? Mm. You know, when you're trying to get it funded, when you're talking to people, and I'm like, I've got no references. No. Like, literally none. No. I don't have a single reference. I've got some films that I didn't want it to be like, and there's a few films that I made people see, which are sort of nothing to do with this, but speak to something about the film, whatever that might be. But so I went into it sort of, not underprepared, that's not true, but I knew I just wanted to feel every moment of it, bit by bit. And we shot the film pretty much in order. We did all the parent stuff first, but all in order. And with the actors, it was very clear that they just had to not think of themselves as being in the past. They have to feel like this is their present.
Yeah.
And you're right about Claire, because it's so easy to give a little wink to the audience, go, don't worry, I don't think like this.
Yeah.
But she did not once. She just stuck with what she knew she had to do. And it's all the more powerful and emotional performance because of it, because she's not doing that. And they're amazing. It's so important when you've got four actors that the performances are all of the same timber, let's say. So they all connect, so you're like, this all makes sense. If one of them is out of whack with the others doesn't work. Like, Jamie seems perfectly in sync with Claire, and it all seems perfectly in sync with Andrew and Paul. And Paul is never in any scenes, apart from one scene in the bed briefly. Yeah. Still, he seems to have the same type of performance that is coming out.
Yeah. And as a writer, I want to bring you in again as a writer as well, Joan, because you're a writer as well as an actor. But what brought you to the material in the first place? I mean, I've got to confess I haven't read the novel, but did you come to the novel, I think, or did you come to the... I know there is a Japanese version of the... There's a film, or an existing film from the late 80s. Did you come to that and think, I want to revise that, I want to bring to it a kind of a new slant? Well, how does it work?
Yeah, the book came to me, and they'd actually been trying to make it, I think... From what I hear, Antti Minghella was trying to make it for quite a long time.
Oh, really?
A long, long time ago. And the film never got made. And then I think it was with Stephen Woolley, the producer, for quite a while. Lots of people have tried to make versions of it.
You didn't tell me that.
And so the book came to me. The book is so different. It's a very traditional ghost story. There's no gay relationship in the story.
Right.
There's a female love story, female character who falls in love with the main character, but she's evil and tries to destroy everyone. It's a whole different thing. And so I read the book, and I was like, I don't know what I can do. I don't know if this is actually for me. But then it was just that central idea of being able to go back into the past to meet your parents again. But more importantly, it's about meeting a past version of yourself.
Right.
More than it is almost meeting your parents again. It's about if I could meet a version of my past as I was then, that is still so part of me now. And you know, you live through so much of the pain that you go through as a kid. And so I started thinking about it, and I knew that the only way I could do it would be to make it feel as personal as it could be to me. Now, my parents are still alive, which is obviously not... My parents aren't ghosts, so it's slightly different. But I'd say outside of that, it's such a personal story for me. And so the more that I just got into it, the more it just sort of became my own. And I was nervous about that and thought, do I want to do that? Do I want to be... Because it's exposing when you make something... write something that feels personal.
I was going to ask you about that, about your parents. My parents are sadly both dead. Mm. And one of my own responses to this movie was, I wonder what they would think. Mm. I wonder what it would be like if I could... And I almost kind of imagine it a little bit now. Mm. Imagine what it would be like if my mum and dad were here. Mm. And the experience of watching stuff. Watching your movie on television in our front room.
Yeah.
Not so much in the theatre, but in our front room at that... awful thing that we had of watching a sex scene with your mum and dad and sort of dying inside and thinking, now wait, you know, that's wrong, that's a kind of unevolved thing for me to say, you know, what, you know, how naive of me to think that they would just be like that, because I'm a grown-up, they're grown-ups in my mind, what it would be like if I was watching this and think, mum, dad, what do you think, you know, and they would probably tell me something really interesting that I didn't know about them and about me. What do you? I was going to ask you. Are your parents still alive, Joe? Mm-hmm.
But one of the things you get so well in the film is the vigour of the youthful parent. And as you get older, your parents get older, and you don't see them in that light. And then suddenly, you've got this privilege of going back to see these vigorous parents with this brilliant plot point that they died at that, you know, when they were younger than he is now, and that vigorous adult conversation between these two, this is an impossible conversation, but it has ramifications that go in many directions.
Yeah. What I found, now this is all over and I've done lots of Q&As and the film's been out on the camera, what I found so interesting for me on like a personal level basically, is that I've sort of managed to have conversations in the film with my parents that I still can't have in real life with them, which is really fascinating. So with my mum's seen it like, I don't know, 80 times, whatever. She keeps going to screenings and like hugging people. And so, but there's still conversations that I can't have with my mum that I've sort of managed to have in the film, but I can't have with my mum. And then my dad, he's got dementia, so he can't see the film. And so that's been a strange thing. So it's like I've sort of had a conversation with my dad in the film that I can't have in real life. He just knows nothing about the film, doesn't know it exists. So it's been a very strange experience. And you sort of would think, people say, is it cathartic? And it sort of is, but not in the way I thought it would be. It's cathartic in that I've managed to put it into a film, but it hasn't, it's not any different in my real life.
It's changed your life.
No.
I think it's what's the other thing that really brings it home to you is not simply that by with this amazing technique of making all the same age, you suddenly realize that it's not simply that you are the child, but you are the parents as well. I'm trying to imagine, because my son is now an adult, thinking, oh yeah, now I'm dad. He's going to think all those silly, stupid things that I did. He's going to think, yeah, God, do you remember when dad always used to say this? And I was thinking to myself, that's the super cool kind of thing that I do all the time, not the sort of stupid dad thing, isn't it? And that's the other thing. I don't know how you responded, but I realised that, no, wait, I'm the ghost. It's like a sort of, no, wait, I'm the ghost drifting around my house, and when my son comes back from uni to see us, he thinks, oh, yeah, God, this house is always the same, isn't it? Yeah, God, that's a boring old house, and thinking that's the other. Yeah. I mean, it's amazing. It's liberating in a way to think, yes, now I'm the ghost now, but I'm not ready to be a ghost. I still think of myself as a young, thrusting young person, not the kind of old geezer.
It's those transitions, isn't it, in your life that they just sort of vanish without you realizing. So I'm a parent too, and it's a strange thing because suddenly you realize that you're a parent, but you're still a child as well. And so I wanted the film to be about parenting as much as it was about being a kid of a parent. You know, and I think when you realize that most parents also make so many mistakes, but they're just still kids. They may be 40, 50, they're still their own kids, and they've got their own problems with their own parents, and they'll never escape that. So you're sort of, there's just so much sort of goes down through the generations of things that aren't said and things that aren't communicated.
When I first saw the film, the puzzle, there's such a puzzle in it, isn't there, of the where are we, when, how is that real, what's real, what's not, all of the puzzle elements. So I spent a lot of time thinking about that the first time. But the second time of seeing it isn't, I don't have to think that through. And so it felt to me like a film of, in relation to what you're talking about with parenting, a film of apologies. And the power of love, of course, is everything. It defines really what the film talks about. But this means to achieving love, it seems to be through apology and responsibility. And I found that so moving today, the power of just the parents saying sorry, and Adam saying sorry, and Harry saying sorry. Those things they all work to create a beautiful resolution and a sense of hope at the end.
Yeah. For me, like, love is all based on, like, being known and knowing somebody and being understood by that person and them being compassionate towards your pain, I suppose. And I've always found it so interesting how people seem to separate parental love and romantic love and see them as two different things. But to me, they're just absolutely identical apart from the obvious differences. They are pretty identical in terms of what the feeling is that you need from somebody. You need from your partner kind of what you need from your parents, which is sort of love and compassion and care and tenderness and understanding. And I think sometimes we spend so long trying to disassociate the two, and then it was quite, I enjoyed bringing those two things together and combining those two forms of love to sort of explore what I think it means at its essence.
That's certainly what I was going to ask about, the amazing scene where Adam is literally in his old kind of wincier pyjamas and gets into bed. And it could so easily have been a sort of hilarious comic scene, and yet it wasn't. I took it absolutely seriously. It was as if the past and the present really were fused in the most amazing way. And it could have been just a big joke, but it wasn't. I mean, it was humorous, of course it was, but when Paul's character appears in it as well, it doesn't feel like a gag. It doesn't feel like a big sketch thing. What was it like rehearsing with that? Was it a long evolved process, or did you go bang straight into it?
Just straight. Look, there were so many things in the script that I was like, oh my God, this could really not work. Like, that scene is one of them, and when I first saw him in his pyjamas, I'm like, oh God. You know, or when, like, Claire starts to sing around the Christmas tree, I'm like, really? So I'm going to have the mother singing to the petrol boys an apology to her son. Is this going to work? Yeah. But in the end, you just have to believe that it will. But that's that scene in the bed. You know, it's one take, actually, the whole scene. So it was the longest, like 6 minutes. It's basically a roll of film. Right. So there was no coverage. I knew there was going to be no coverage. And I love putting just the constraints on a scene. So, I mean, the reality of that scene is you've got people rolling out of the bed and other people trying to roll back in again.
Yeah, must be.
There's all of those things. That's what I was thinking. And we're in a tiny room and there's a camera stuck up above and it's ridiculous in real life. And then Claire and Andrew are trying to do this beautiful scene while, like, Jamie's sneaking out of the bed. But that's the thing. That's the crazy thing about making films. You're like, and you know, like, you're trying to capture something that feels so, like, truthful and vulnerable and whatever it is. And you've got all of this shit of a film around you. And I try very hard to make that feel as small as possible. So you can just feel like that's all vanished. So the actors can just feel like there's no one else here and there's just me and I can do this thing. I do that with every scene. If I try to have so few people on set. I don't want anybody there that needs to be there. No monitors in sight of anybody, nothing. So you just, because it's, I mean, it's a terrifying thing to be an actor. And to actually, you talked about those kind of close-ups, and if you watch the film again, you realise that the close-ups sort of come as you go through the film, they get tighter and tighter. Mm-hmm. And to me, that's not just an aesthetic choice, that's just like knowing, because I'm shooting relatively in order, the actor probably will not be ready to like show a vulnerability until they've worked on the film, until they've got to know me better. So I always try and work it out, like, when do I think the actor's going to be there at the right time to sort of give the performance that they want to give. Does that make sense?
And was it a very... how drawn out a process was it? I mean, did you have to do many takes to find that thing? Or was it just...
We did 10 takes, but that was only because of the first 5 takes that we shot on film, the film ran out towards the end.
Yeah.
So I'm like, oh God, it's like, Jesus. Because I knew there was going to be no... And then Claire and Andrew were like laughing and giggling and came and said, guys, stop it. You have to start the minute that we roll camera, and no talking, and we've got to get this done because it's 5 minutes and the roll of film is 5 minutes.
Because the potential for comedy, in a good way, is
absolutely
amazing. I mean, the scene... I mean, it blows my mind every time I think about it, when Claire sees his body and realises... You look like my dad. He can't. You realise he's not imagining it. This isn't his writerly reverie. It's actually happening. The ghost has appeared to him and has told him something new about himself. It's funny and sad all at the same time. It's amazing.
I just love that way you can do something that feels absurd, and ridiculous, and can be quite funny, and then you can just switch it gently and quickly, and suddenly it's full of pathos and sadness and whatever. And I don't like to watch a scene that is just sad from the beginning, and then comes, and it's still always sad. Like, it doesn't work. You have to have some, you've got to ride it, so you're always like, oh, it's just like, oh God, oh my God, no. So they move through it in a way that keeps them engaged, I suppose.
It reminded me, as I say, there's almost no filmic kind of precedent for it in a way. It reminded me of Dickens. There's a kind of Dickensian energy to it, I think. I think Dickens would have enjoyed this film, to be honest with you. I think he would have understood what you were trying to do. It also reminded me a little bit of Ian McEwan's The Child in Time.
Oh, I've never read that.
Well, there's a real... I'd be fascinated to hear what you think of it, because it really reminded me of that, of suddenly... of a kind of a real miracle, a natural miracle, access into the past, that you've found this, by accident, you found a wormhole, a time-space portal back into the past. But it doesn't feel like sci-fi, and it doesn't feel romantic, it's just like a natural thing that's happened. So I really felt that it was Dickensian, though. It really felt like that to me.
With a bit of Back to the Future.
Bit of Back to the Future, yes. Well, Back to the Future was all about Freud. I mean, it was all about fancying your mum.
Yeah.
Which is something...
There's a bit of fancying your dad.
Fancying your dad? Well, I wondered that again. I thought it was... Because I knew... Because I came to this... Knowing nothing about it, the scene at the very beginning where he sees him... And he kind of nods, come with me. And I thought, okay, I get it. I understand what's happening now. Yeah. And then it totally upends you. You think, no, you don't understand it at all. Oh, my God, this is... It blows my mind. Yeah. It's absolutely amazing. But tell me, again, it sounds like a kind of sort of Hello Magazine question to ask, but did you talk to the actors about their parents? I mean, did Claire or Paul sort of volunteer stuff to you about, do you know, my parents would have said this to me or something like that?
Yeah, like, look, the thing, I don't rehearse in any sort of traditional sense prior to it. We maybe went through a couple of the scenes, but not really. But to me, it is about, I talk to them about my life and my experience with my parents, how right. I feel about my relationship with my parents. And then you kind of hope that they will then return the favour and talk to me about their lives. And I think that's what we did. I think all of us were very open about our lives and our fears and, you know, the complications of growing up and all those kind of things. And especially for me and Andrew, because it's, you know, Andrew's obviously the centre of the film, and, you know, we're both the same age, we both grew up gay in the 80s. There was a shared experience that we all had in relationship to that. Right. So me and him, we talked a lot about how we felt growing up, you right. know, under the spectre of AIDS, and how that felt when you were, you know, coming into your sexuality in the 80s as a kind of young gay person. And so we talked a lot about that, and it's all of those conversations sort of help you all understand the film in a way that then I don't think you need to do too much rehearsal outside of that, because you understand what it is we're trying to explore and pick at and get at. And then I sort of rehearsed a little bit in the mornings and then on the day, but then just kind of go for it. I don't know. Do you rehearse a lot? Do you like to rehearse?
I do like to rehearse, but it's not usually very much time to be able to do so. I feel hugely proud to live in Croydon and this film to have been made. I honestly do. This cinema, of course, is named after David Lean, who was born in Croydon. And we recently had a wonderful Q&A with Art Malik and Patrick Cadell, who was the first assistant director on Passage to India, following a screening to Passage to India. And Art Malik was recounting how David Lean had told him that when they were sort of sitting around in India waiting for various takes, how when he was a child in Croydon, he and a teenager, he would save up as much money as possible, come from just down the road in South Croydon into Croydon itself to go to the cinema, and that he was completely dedicated to getting as much cinema and culture as possible, and then to London was that little bit beyond. And I think you expressed so beautifully in the writing when Claire, when Mum says to Adam, "I knew you'd do something creative." This sense of the suburbs and the outside and the metropolitan centre. And I think anybody who lives here in this area will be so... This is palpable, this sense of whether you're... How close or far you are from this, you know, mecca of cultural activity. So I'm curious as to your experiences as a boy with culture and Croydon and London and everything that, you know, the suburbs mean.
Yeah. I mean, look, my parents were, you know, my dad worked for a drinks company. My mum, when I was young, didn't work. She actually now works. But so they weren't from cultural. They didn't do, like, cultural jobs. I was on a panel once with lots of other directors, and they went around and everyone was like, what does your parents do? And they're like, oh, my dad's a philosopher. My dad's a film director. And I'm like... I don't work for, like, Bass. So it's like it's a very different thing. But when I was growing up, the culture was pretty limited for us. And, you know, there's a reason I put the Whitgift Centre in the film. It's because I genuinely loved it. I genuinely loved coming there. It felt like a dream of the future. So this is, like, I guess, late 70s, early 80s, that kind of time. You know, and I went to... My first concert was Bucks Fizz in the Fairfield Halls. Still the happiest moment of my life. And then I think I also saw Shakin' Stevens in the Fairfield Halls. So these were amazing times. So, like, that's the funny thing when you're a kid. The excitement you get isn't necessarily in, I don't know, amazing places. It can be like, you know, the reason I wanted to set the ending of the film in that diner was, like, when I was a kid, I remember I moved with my dad somewhere, and I was so excited we were near a Happy Eater. You know Happy Eaters?
Yeah.
That, to me, was the most exciting thing I could ever possibly imagine. Like, we're going to be near a Happy Eater? We can have, like, pancakes? Little Chef was the same. So it's like, the things when you're a kid that you find exciting are so interesting. So So culturally, I feel like it took me until I was in my teenage years, really, actually, when I didn't live here anymore, to start sort of realising there was a wider culture that I can invest in myself. I mean, you know, we went to London so infrequently. We went. My mum got some tickets from Woman's Own to go and see The Secret of NIMH in Leicester Square. I think that was my first time going to a major cinema, and that was up in London. And all I wanted to do was go to the Wimpy afterwards. So. I don't know what that says about me as a kid. Food. Which,
yeah, I remember. For me, it was the Brent Cross Shopping Centre and the Golden Egg. Was it the Golden Egg? Do you remember the Golden Egg? Yes, that was it. I remember because Peter O'Toole was banned from the Golden Egg, from getting the one in Leicester Square for getting drunk and being. Wow. But I want to bring in the audience. If the audience has any questions, yes, sir.
Yes. 3 points. First one is thank you for a wonderful film that shows Croydon. Thanks for that. Cheers, you're thrusting my face. Firstly, thanks for a wonderful film that shows Croydon in a great light, considering all the negative press we normally get. So thank you for that. And also for the fact that my daughter, my youngest, turned around and said, Dad, you'll love it. You said, you'll cry, but you'll love it. And she was right. The second part is, the second part's a bit of a weird one. Do you remember the Travelator that used to go up to the Forum? God, if you could have bought that back, you would have been my hero. And the very last one is, the number 6, did it feature, was there any significance there at all? Because I looked at it and I thought you kept focusing on 6, and I'm thinking not you know, Bruce Willis, Sixth Sense and all that kind of cobblers, but was there any significance there, or did you just choose 6th floor because it was easy?
Easy.
Good man. I like.
I'd like to say there's a reason for everything. Sometimes I'm just like, well, 6 makes sense.
6, yeah, exactly. It's the one big thing, problem reviewing a film actually, is that you've got people saying, you know, it's a bit like The Sixth Sense. Shut up. Yeah. Stop saying that.
Everybody likes to work out what it's like.
Hang on, what it's like.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, don't say that. Apart from everything else, you'll ruin it. Yes, anybody else? Yes, you, sir.
I was just wondering about the scenes in the apartment and whether that was a set or if that was a real apartment.
Paul, can you say it again in the mic?
Oh, sorry. I was just wondering about the scenes in the apartment and whether it was a real apartment or a set, and particularly because of the way that you view through the windows, the sort of the aesthetic of that and that kind of the...
Yes, it was a set. We'd originally wanted to shoot in an apartment block, but no one ever lets you film in an apartment block because it's so complicated in London. And also it's a nightmare to film because, you know, if you're 22 floors up, it's just impossible to light outside an apartment. And actually... we wanted to build a set because I wanted it to feel slightly unreal at the same time. So we used, there were huge actually LED screens outside on the set, and we projected what you see in the film. So when you're in the set, when we're shooting in the set, it looks like you are in an apartment and the background is the background. But it was all on these like moving screens, which actually was, I'd never done it before. They used it on like Star Wars, so I was very excited to be able to do it. But I knew that, and Jamie the DP has done something focally with it, so you sort of see more than you would normally if you're shooting in a real location. You're seeing more of the outside. And for me that was really important because I wanted you to get into that apartment and feel like something's not quite like real. I think it is too real. You're not going to believe where it goes. Mm. So I had to start from this place of sort of like, okay, everything is slightly shifted anyway. Like no one's on their phones. There's no mobiles. No. Nothing sort of. It doesn't. It feels real, but it sort of doesn't feel real. And I feel like you're trying to get to this space that is essentially getting more and more internal and more like within its own head. If you want to see it, is that, or whether it's ghosts or whatever you want to see it. Mm. I feel like I had to start from that slightly strange place.
It's very. It reminded me a little of J.G. Ballard, actually. Yeah, the high rise of J.G. Ballard. The slightly sinister tower block where it feels oppressive.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. Oh, you've got the microphone. Yes.
Hi. I wanted to ask you about the clothing in the film. As Joanna said, the sort of past and the present are so intrinsically linked. And what I thought was really clever, particularly with Harry, Paul's character, is that his clothing, it felt quite 80s. I was born in the late 80s. It reminded me a lot of hand-me-downs I got from my brother. But it also, like, you know, I have friends that dress a lot like Harry now. So I just wondered if that was something you intentionally wanted, or if that was something your costume designer suggested to you.
Yeah, it's something we talked a lot about, actually. Like, you know, I always think, you know, for Adam himself, his clothes still have sort of a callback to 80s, 90s, perhaps. And I think, you know, you bring with you your past in everything that you wear. Like, I kind of wear the same things I've worn for years. And you do that. And then for Harry, it was really interesting to me that he's younger, obviously, you know. But I wanted him to feel like he also was almost like a version of his dad. There's a similarity between Harry and the dad. They've both got moustaches. There's something about the clothes that they're wearing. And so it was very intentional that he felt like there was this kind of 80s look that he had. And also, look, for me, the whole film, however you want to see it, it's a manifestation of Adam's state of mind. Doesn't mean it can't be, you can see them as real ghosts, you can do. And so I wanted all of these people to sort of feel like they speak to the past as well as speaking to the present. So it doesn't feel like it's a story set in the present, he gets on the train, and he goes back to the past. That felt like it wouldn't work. It all had to feel like it was mushing up together in everything. The colours of the apartment are sort of based on the colours in the house, but they're made deeper coloured and brighter. But there's all things from the house end up in the thing. The record player is the same record player. All of these things sort of dragged between the two spaces.
We've got time for one more.
Just the one more, please. Yes.
It's a lot of pressure.
Yeah.
I was going to ask a technical question, actually. You mentioned that you used film, and you know the limitations of that. I just wondered what your personal reason was for using film. Was it specifically for this film, or is it something you like to do?
I've only shot a film I did called 45 Years was shot on film as well, and I really do love working on film. It's not always possible for budget reasons, but I just think it has an aesthetic that video doesn't have. And for me, there's so much that is analog, I guess, in the film, photographs, like records. So it felt such a shame to then shoot the whole film digitally when there's all of these things that feel so organic and touchable and you can feel them. You know, film is light burning off celluloid, and I love that concept. And also, it also helped, look, it gives it an aesthetic that in our minds recalls the past anyway, somehow, because we know old films and they're all shot on film. And so there was talk at one point of shooting sort of the present day stuff, if you want to call it that, on video, on digital, and then film, but I didn't want that either. I felt like it had to feel like it was together. But film now, shot on film again, I'm like, the next film I'm doing, I'm like, it's just got to be on film. It's just, there's something special about it, you know, and yeah, I love it.
Well, that's a wonderful note to end on. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for coming.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for the experiment, and thank you for the good habit.
Thanks for listening, and thank you to the lovely people at the always excellent David Lean Cinema for facilitating our presence at their event. Under the Flyover is the podcast strand of Inside Croydon, premium content for paid-up subscribers to the website, available on Spotify and via Patreon.